But it's great to have you guys here. It's great to have some of you folks to experience our community for the first time. And that's what it is. It's a community. And that's one of the things that we work so hard to establish, is that sense of community, that sense of place, a safe place where we can come. And what it really comes down to is experiment with our spiritual journeys. Because there are so many ways at coming at God. And we're wired differently. Every one of us is different. Every one of us is going to experience our God in a different way, ultimately. And so trying to find that way, that's, I guess, that sweet spot for yourself. How is it that you connect with God most securely? It's not that we don't want balance. It's not that there aren't multiple ways that we're going to utilize as we go through. But to find that place that really connects with us is one of the keys to really being able to love the spiritual life, enjoy the spiritual life as we go through it. There are really many ways of coming at God, if you think about it. And the four that I sort of identified that kind of hold as categories for lots of others are intellectually, emotionally, liturgically, and legally. These are four ways that we have, both as individuals and as groups, as institutions, as churches, have used and utilized to be able to find our way to God, to know Him better. That's the goal, to know God better. And so sometimes we do it intellectually. Often we do it intellectually. You know, that's going to be a focus on Scripture. It's going to be a focus on doctrine. It's going to be a focus on rational thought, trying to understand things about God so that we can move closer to Him. Emotionally, you know, I go back, my mom goes back to the charismatic movement, especially in the Catholic Church where she was planted at the time. And that idea of the felt response of God, people talking about being drunk in the Spirit, slain in the Spirit, you know, holy laughter, these felt emotional responses to God's presence, you know, that kind of visceral connection. And then liturgically, the focus is going to be on ritual practice. The focus is going to be on the traditions of the church. I grew up in the Catholic Church. We interfaced with God, if you will, through the liturgy, through that ritual that was performed Sunday after Sunday and day after day. That was the connection point. And then finally, legally, dealing with ethical and moral values, ethical and moral systems, good works, charitable, you know, effects, and even social justice, all of these areas here included in that legal understanding. And all of these are perfectly valid and wonderful and necessary ways that we come at God. And the idea is to be balanced between all of them. But each one of us is wired a different way. Each one of us is going to naturally gravitate to one of these more than the others. And so we're going to have strong hands, we're going to have weak hands, and it's really essential for us as true seekers to strengthen the weak hand, try to find some balance. But there's one more way that I've found, and that was the way that finally spoke to me, because my bias, I suppose, my strength is the intellectual way, you know, and so I always want to figure things out. I always want to work through them. You know, I bet you never figured that out, right, after listening to me for a while. But it was this other way that helped me to start to let go of that, to reduce that in importance and balance everything out. And that's what's usually called the contemplative way. And I wanted to talk to you about the contemplative way a bit this morning, because what I found in the spiritual journey, that it wasn't like anything else that I had experienced in life. And that was my problem. I spent so much time trying to acquire the things of the Spirit the way that I acquired the things in all of the rest of my life, all the material things I needed, everything that I went for in life. I used the same tools to get there, and it was eluding me. It didn't work. You know, after years of pounding away, I was just as neurotic as I was when I started. You know, what was going to make the change? What was this kingdom Jesus was talking about? What was this born-againness that Jesus was talking about? What was this baptism in the Spirit that the church was talking about? I couldn't get there. I couldn't break through, and I couldn't understand why. Because if we take any one of those ways that I just described and overuse them or focus only on them, then it turns into a detriment. If the intellectual way is overused, then it's going to turn into just a search for pure knowledge. separation, a subject and an object, even can turn into an arrogance, a sense that I know more than other people, or that knowledge is the way to God, or gets me closer to God, or is some sort of power or something like that, that doctrine. And if we overuse the emotional way, then we move into a place of inconsistency, because emotions are inconsistent. They don't always show up the way that we want to, and then we end up chasing them and trying to create them as if it's the emotion itself that is the connection with God. And in the liturgical sense, man, growing up Catholic, I'll tell you, I had no idea what the symbols meant in all of that liturgy. And so it was just meaningless repetition over and over again. And a sense of obligation that I had to do this, that somehow doing these things was earning God's approval. But shorn from the meaning behind the symbols, the liturgy just becomes just a clanging gong, nothing going on. And then finally, legal. You know, obedience for obedience' sake, doing good works as if those somehow brought us into God's favor. Each one of those has that flip side if we focus too much on them. But what the contemplative way has done for me, and I hope can do for you, is to just synthesize all of those, bring them all together, wrap them up, and see that every one of those is a way through to a deeper connection. To an actual connection. What is contemplation? What is this contemplative way that we are talking about this morning? You know, it's a little bit hard to define, as anything is of the spirit, you know, but I suppose you could say it's the state of being present to God's presence. Simply being present to God's presence. There's a definition here I found that is interesting and possibly useless. You'll have to tell me. It goes, contemplation is the search for a content-free mind directed toward awareness of God as a living reality. What do you think? A content-free mind directed toward the awareness of God as a living reality. It's all there. It makes perfect sense, and it may be perfectly useless, but In practice, what they're talking about is a clearing away of all of those things, all of those ways we talked about, everything that you think you know, everything that you think you understand, and most importantly, everything that you have learned to cling to as your security blanket, as your teddy bear, as your life preserver. To clear that out, to clear your mind of all that content, so that you've got a clear shot to just be and see what is really there in the moment. Not through the filter of your experience and all of your biases and all of your viewpoints, but just really see what is there. That's contemplation. There's a lot of things that go into it. Typically, it's exercised in a certain amount of solitude and silence. Typically, it's exercised in contemplative prayer, which is a prayer without words. There are techniques that will allow you to clear the content out of your mind, to step aside from your thoughts. But it has to do with also just living your life with a certain attitude, with a certain way that takes you in every moment to that place. Contemplation, the experience of stripping away everything, descending into a place where there is nothing left but God. I love the image of a dog pile. Those of you who played football, or maybe just played on the grass with your friends, and everybody piles on, and you're pulling bodies away and bodies away. Finally, you get down just to the grass. You know, at the bottom of the dog pile that is in your head, at the bottom of the dog pile of your content-filled mind, as you peel these things away and pull them away and quiet, what is left at the bottom? You and God. Getting there is the key. And let's face it, everything is against us. Everything is against us in doing this. Our society does not value descent. Our society does not value silence. Our society does not value introspection. Everything is just out there blaring away over and over and over again. It is so hard for us to be able to find any kind of solitude and silence in our busy lives, in this culture, at this time in history, at this place on the globe. We are at serious disadvantage. So if it's going to be done, then we're going to have to really work at doing it. And before we're going to be willing to work at doing it, we have to see the value in it. Does Jesus have any value in contemplative prayer? Let's take a look and see if we can find something here. Matthew 6, 1 to 8, and you can look up on the screens or look into your bulletins right now. It's there. This is right in the center of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is redefining righteousness as the Pharisees and the people generally of Israel understood their righteousness, which boiled down to three things: prayer, charitable acts, giving, and fasting. And so Jesus is dealing with a couple of these right now. Right at verse 1, he says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they might be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. So do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him." Okay, you probably get a general sense of where Jesus is going here. But let's take that section starting at verse 5. This idea of going into the prayer closet, this idea of separating yourself from all of the religious practice and the people and everything that's going on and moving into your inner room can be taken literally, and it can also be taken spiritually, and it needs to be taken both at the same time. Jesus is talking about a physical movement. The Jews were required to pray three times a day. They all knew when those times were. The Pharisees and the religious leaders made sure that they were in the most conspicuous place at those times during the day, so that when they prayed, they would be seen by everyone. It was their religious practice. It was their form of letting everyone know how righteous they were. Jesus said, don't be like that. Just move away physically into a place where you can be alone with your Father. But the same thing is true interiorly, spiritually. Close down. Get separated from all of that stuff that is constantly going on in your head and come to this place, because your Father who lives there in secret, your Father who lives in that place inside of you, inside your room, knows everything about you. All of this connection takes place when the rest of this stuff goes away. He's making a huge point here. He's trying to teach us our spirituality lives on two levels. As long as we're breathing here, as long as we have social concerns and we have religious practice, we're going to live at that level. But if we don't start to learn to retreat, to come into that deeper place, then it all just becomes surface. We never go in for landing. That knowing of God will be shelved off. It'll be stopped at those ways that we come at God that have now become our blockage to God. And notice what he does here. That religious practice of praying three times a day in public and doing all this, Jesus is saying, separate from that. Separate from that liturgical practice, right? Come away from that. Come back in. It's not that there's anything wrong with the liturgical practice, but make sure that it takes you through to the deeper understanding, the deeper connection with your God. When he talks about up there at the top paragraph, "Do not sound the trumpet before men." This is the practice of the Pharisees, once again, to make a big show of how much money they were giving to the poor. They would bang big wads of coins into the collection receptacles in the courtyard of the temple that were shaped conically like a trumpet bell, and sound the trumpet. Jesus is saying, pull away from that legal, ethical, moral show and come back in to the connection point. Do that in secret so that it has nothing to do with obligation. It has nothing to do with show. It has everything to do with personal connection with those whom you're helping. When he talks about not using meaningless repetition, this works on two levels. First, the intellectual. This word-based communication that we're constantly pounding away on over and over again. Even our prayer life, our prayers have become just word fests. We're always talking. Or we're listening for other words, but we're keeping that content in our mind, never allowing it to dissipate, never allowing ourselves to just move in. Stop using those words, he's saying. Let go of that. Just come in and be. And also at the emotional level, because what he's talking about here are the mantras and the chants of the pagan religions that were meant to whip you into a frenzy, into emotional frenzy. Don't worry about that. Let that go as well. Come back in. When Jesus went to the mountain to pray, or went into the wilderness to pray, especially after difficult days, difficult times, and spent the whole night there and then came back in the morning, or possibly longer, of course, this is what he was doing. He was going into his inner chamber. He was going into his prayer closet. He was separating himself from all of this stuff so he could reconnect with his source, reconnect with his Father in heaven. And then come back to the community, come back and minister as he was ministering. I think this is what he's also emphasizing in John 3:8. The wind blows where it wishes and you hear the sound of it, but do not know where it comes from and where it's going. So is everyone who is born of the Spirit. In this passage, he's trying to get Nicodemus to understand the difference between the physical and the spiritual. What is born of flesh is flesh, and what is born of spirit is spirit. And he's trying to separate the two. And he uses this beautiful image of the wind that you can't see, but the effect of it is palpable. And it's the same thing with the spirit and this contemplation. It exists on this deeper level. We need to separate from all of these things, these details, these things that we do, so we can get to this place of pure being. It's hard to express. We have to kind of come at it sideways. We have to use word pictures and evoke responses in people, because it's not intellectual. We're not going to get it just through the mind that way. We're a culture, both religious and secular, that is so opposite all of this that it's going to fight us at everything that we do. And, you know, these things are not bad in and of themselves. I'm not saying that. These things we're trying to separate ourselves from. Only if it is standing between you and the presence of your God does it become a problem for you. It's our attachment to these things. It's our attitude toward these things. It's our identification with these things as if they are us. That is when they become an issue. Think about the rich young man who came to Jesus and asked, "What must I do to obtain eternal life?" And Jesus goes through the list with him about following the commandments. He says, "I've already done this." And Jesus knew it. He knew that he was telling him the truth. And it says that he loved him as he looked at him and saw his sincerity and saw what it was that he was really trying to do. And yet there was one thing he lacked. He was hanging on to his riches, hanging on to his position as that security blanket. What he really relied on when it all came down to it, at the bottom of his dog pile, were his physical, material riches and his position in the community. That's what he relied on. That was his block. That's why he knew that with everything that he had been doing, intellectually, emotionally, liturgically, and legally, it wasn't enough. There was something missing. And Jesus says to him, "Then sell all your possessions and give them to the poor and come follow me." He's not ready to do that. He's not yet ready to let go. It's a hard thing to let go. It's so hard to let go of these things. Now, for him, it was physical riches and material. For all of us, it's going to be something different. Now, I can say for me, it doesn't have anything to do with material riches. That's not the thing that connects me. If you've seen the van that I drive, you know what I'm talking about. Some of you are laughing because you know the van that I drive. My dirty 84 Vanagon, it's just fine for me. I love it. It doesn't bother me. I spent 15 years working down the ladder of success so that I could be in full-time ministry. And poor Marianne, I'm so sorry, honey. She's being dragged along with me, you know. I was at the peak of my earning in 1990, I think. And it's been going down ever since. You know? And the clothes I wear, too, it doesn't bother me. You know, I wear the same thing every day. You all know that. You see me Sunday after Sunday, you know. It was funny. Frank and I went to a conference, and there was a man there wearing blacks, you know, the Roman collar and the blacks of a cleric. And so I assumed that he was a Catholic priest or an Episcopal priest or something, so I got a chance to come up and talk to him. Turns out he's a Methodist pastor, and he said, "You know what, I just got tired of trying to figure out what I was going to wear every day. This is so easy. I just put it on," and he says, "and guess what? You get free parking at hospitals whenever you go there." You know, they just look at you from the guard booth and they let you in. Hey, what do you think, Frank? Should we start wearing blacks? Now, that would be weird if we walked in here with a... But it would be so great because then I wouldn't have to think about it. Because these things... Now, those things don't interest me at all. Took me 10 solid years to try to work through my fixation on the intellectual, however. 10 solid years before I felt I had the first breakthrough, because that had the stranglehold on my mind. Here was Jesus for 10 years saying, sell everything you have, give it to the poor. Sell that content-filled mind. Let it go and come follow me. And I couldn't do it. I went away sad. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I didn't even know what I was refusing. I didn't even know what I was rejecting. I didn't really even hear the call like that to sell it all. I knew something was wrong, though. I knew for everything that I was doing, studying for the pastorate, I knew that there was something missing. There was something wrong. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. The contemplative way, though, finally revealed to me what it was that I was hanging on to. The willingness to consistently strip things away. And, you know, it doesn't come off all at once. It comes off in layers. That's the difference. You think, oh, I can just do this. You know, where's the big conversion moment? Where is the born-again experience? Where is the magic pill? When do I just become this new creature in Christ? Day after day, moment after moment, decision after decision to let go and strip away another layer and another layer and another layer. And finally you can see clearly enough to see what it was that you were missing all this time. Contemplative practice allows that to begin to happen. Allows it to be. So what is the thing that you're attached to? What is the way that you most securely follow? Intellectual, emotional, liturgical, legal? What is it that you're clinging on to? At the bottom of your dog pile, what is really there? Do you know? Have you explored that unexplored territory enough to know what's going on in your life? Richard Rohr has a take on this, and this is something that we've been reading on Wednesday nights, and we hit this last Wednesday, and I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs here. Because the question on your mind should be, okay, Dave, that sounds pretty screwy, but maybe a little intriguing, so... But the question is, how do we do it? How do we get there? He talks about this concept of liminality and transformation. Let me just read a little bit and see if anything gets clear for you. He writes, "Let me introduce you to a concept anthropologists call liminality. It's also called liminal space. The Latin word limen means threshold. It is central to initiation rites and is a good metaphor for the preparation for transformation." Okay, preparation for transformation. That's what we're after, transformation, being born again. Contemplative practice is taking us there, all right? So this threshold is this metaphor we're going to use. We discuss it frequently in our men's retreats. We find ourselves in a strange position in the West. We alone, of all the centuries of civilization, culture, and tribe, do not have initiation rites for the young, especially for young men. Other cultures have recognized that people in general, and boys in particular, are not born. They are made. These cultures took it upon themselves to transform a boy into a man. Certain things had to be told him because he would not come to them naturally. The boy would naturally want to ascend, and religion had to teach him the language of descent. He had to learn the way of tears and how to learn to let go. These initiation rites are always about leading the boy out of the world of business as usual. And this business as usual is the cultural trance that we sleepwalk in, he says. And leading him into liminal space. It's a voluntary displacement for the sake of transformation of consciousness, perspective, and heart. People didn't assume that just by getting up every day, they would learn what they needed to know. They had to be displaced and shocked to teach them that this isn't the only world. There is another world, much bigger and more inclusive, that both relativizes and re-enchants this world that we take as normative. If we bring to a retreat all of the baggage and mentality of business as usual, we aren't really making a retreat. So nothing new or transformative can happen. I've given a lot of retreats. Certain people come to hear what they already know. Certain people come to hear what they already know. If I say something they don't know, I can see their arms cross and they mentally pack up and leave. But we hear only what we if we hear only what we already know, we simply cannot learn or grow. That attitude is a sure ticket to ignorance. Alcoholics say that without humility and honesty, nothing new happens. These virtues, humility and honesty, are the foundation of all spirituality, but they are hard won. Most of us have to crawl our way back to them. Usually we don't go unless the pain of circumstances forces us. Jonah didn't dive over the edge of the boat. They threw him in. Liminal space induces a type of inner crisis to help us make a needed transition. In brief, it should wake us up a bit. That's what is meant by a liminal experience. What he's talking about here are rites of passage. Have you heard that term before, rites of passage? You know what? The problem is that we don't have any rites of passage anymore in our culture. As he points out, we're the first culture, the first time period where this has not taken place. It hurts boys a lot more than girls. You know, it's just kind of the biology and the way that things work. You know, boys can stay boys, and that's not a good thing. There is no way for them to know when they have transitioned into manhood. But for all of us spiritually, this metaphor that we're going to use, all of us don't know how or when we transition into spiritual maturity if we don't have a way of actually doing it. And if, even more so, we are avoiding the way that it's done because of the way our culture dictates. The rite of passage, the true rite of passage, has three components. It's separation, transition, and reincorporation. And without those three, you don't really have a rite of passage. We sometimes say, oh yeah, first haircut of my boy, that's a rite of passage. Sometimes we say, oh, the bar mitzvah, that's a rite of passage. Or the debutante ball, or the presentation in Hispanic culture. But when you think about it, all three of those are just the reincorporation. It's just a party. There's no separation. There's no transition. So we don't have anything that really takes us there. Maybe the closest thing in our experience is military life. Going into the military. Being separated from your own life. Having your head shaved. All of your civilian stuff taken away. Given a uniform. Going through a very difficult boot camp. But of course, what we don't do well for our warriors, both male and female, is reincorporate them back. That's why the suicide rate is through the roof among our military veterans, because we don't reincorporate them. They get the separation and the transition, but they don't get to come home. It's tragic. If you look at the Aboriginal cultures, I think it's clearest. Aborigines in Australia with the walkabouts. When the young boy is of age, he is taken away from the village, taken away from the company of women and the company of the other children, and he is taken out into the bush by the men. And there he is given a task to do. He has to, sometimes for 6 months or more, just walk the countryside following the song lines of his culture that create these aural maps that have been taught for generations upon generations. And by just re-singing the songs and following the landmarks that they describe in a particular area, these boys can sometimes travel thousands of kilometers across the bush and across the desert of Central Australia. And then when they come back, having gone through this ordeal, then they are celebrated and brought back into the village, but now as men and not as boys. Other cultures, there's actual cutting involved, piercings, tattooing. It's always painful. It's always risky. There is risk involved. It has to be in order for there to be transition. And then the reincorporation. Where is that in our society? How do we value the pain, the risk? How do we value the disorientation and the fear that is involved in a true rite of passage? One that really takes us on a journey and teaches us something. It just doesn't occur. And for in our religion, that used to be the last thing standing in Western culture that could give us a rite of passage, we have gotten to the point now where we look at painful things if we are in distress, if we are in disorientation, especially if we are in doubt. There's something wrong that has to be fixed. The pain has to be alleviated. No, that's part of the rite of passage. We need to lean into that. We need to move through that, not say that there's something wrong and move away. As if our doubt somehow is the opposite of our faith. Doubt isn't the opposite of faith. Ever thought about that? If you doubt something, all of a sudden, oh, something's wrong. You know, you're losing your faith, brother. It's like, no. Any more than courage is the opposite of fear. Courage is the Courage is the ability to act in the presence of fear. Fear defines the courage. Without fear, there is no courage. Faith is the ability to act in the presence of doubt. Doubt defines the faith. Doubt is necessary for faith. Doubt is how you know you are in a liminal experience. How do you know you're in a liminal experience? Because it hurts. Because it disturbs you. Because it distresses you. Because it's not business as usual. If it feels familiar, if it feels comfortable, you're not in a rite of passage. You are not growing. Nobody grows in the familiar. Nobody grows in the comfortable. We grow when we are pushed out into another place, into a place that we don't understand, into a place where we have to descend to the place where we are stripping away and losing all of the things that we hold on to that we feel keep us safe. Is there a precedent in Jesus' life for this? You betcha. When Jesus is baptized in the River Jordan, immediately afterwards, the Spirit drives him into the wilderness. And it's said that he's there for 40 days. And he gets very hungry and very tired and very thirsty. I can tell you this, 40, wherever it's used, is always symbolic in these contexts. What it means is an initiation, a time of trial and testing into a rebirth, into a transformation. There are 18 unaccounted for years in Jesus' life. It was a lot longer than 40 days. We don't know how long. Paul has 14 unaccounted for years between his Damascus conversion and the beginning of his first missionary journey. It's a long time. Did Jesus really have to learn things? Yeah, he did. He was fully human like every one of us. Luke 2 tells us he grew in wisdom and stature. If he was growing in wisdom, then he had to learn. After his baptism, after his dedication, he goes out into this experience where it's difficult, it's risky, it's life-threatening. He is exhausted. He's hungry. He is in that rite of passage. He's on his walkabout, if you will. And the devil comes and there are three temptations that he's given. And these three are symbolic of all of the obsessive compulsive drives that drive all of us as human beings. You know, the drive for relevance, the drive for power, the drive for spectacular attention, turning loaves, stones into loaves, taking control of all the kingdoms of the world, throwing yourself down spectacularly from the parapet of the temple to be borne up by angels' wings. All of these ways of being able to move forward in life, Jesus had to put down. And he did it with scripture. He did it with connection to his God. And he did it with faith, consistent action, irrespective of whatever was going on, the challenges that he was facing. And it took time. Layers came off. And when he returned, when he was reincorporated, he was able to come back to the community and have something of priceless value to give them. That he and the Father were one. And this is what it looks like to be one with the Father. I have this to give you. Reincorporation, separation, transition, reincorporation. Every one of us needs to go through these. Life will continue to present these to us. So how does it apply? How does it apply for us, this rite of passage, this liminal space that we're talking about? How does it work? Anytime that you're separated from the familiar, every time you're moving into uncharted territory, you know, every time that you are forced to let go of your security blankets, you're moving into a rite of passage. We tend to see these in big terms. Obviously, the biggest transitions are birth and death. We see those. And it's not just for the person being born or dying. It's for the people around them who are experiencing the birth, who will now suddenly be transformed into parents and have to deal with a child in their lives. Or the death of a loved one is a move into that. That grieving process is the pain, is the disorientation of the rite of passage. Sometimes major transitions like going into the military or going into college are rites of passage. Lisa's daughter Hannah is going to be leaving in just a few weeks to go all the way up to Washington State, right? Oregon, to college. First time away from home, this is going to be a liminal experience, not only for Hannah, but for Lisa, who's now going to be dealing with the empty nest. She's already feeling the first disturbances, and has been for some time, of what is it going to be like when I am really on my own. And she has a choice to make. Hannah has a choice to make. As they move into this threshold, across this threshold, into this uncharted territory, it can scare them so much, it can make them so uncomfortable that they fly back to what is familiar and try to recreate the old life in whatever way that they can. Or they can move through it, pick up the tasks that are offered, you know, kind of like Dorothy having to bring back the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. That was a liminal experience, a rite of passage for her. If Hannah and Lisa will pick up those tasks and come back to where they started, they will know something that they didn't know before about themselves. More layers will be peeled off of all of the stuff that separates them from the pure presence of their God. But the temptation here is to always think about it in terms of big stuff. But it's not about the big stuff. It's about every moment of our lives. Because every moment of our lives presents discomfort, disturbance, pain. Maybe not every moment. Every day, though, don't you think? Isn't there something that disturbs you every single day? Even if it's just someone cutting you off on the freeway? There's always something going on, something that can disconnect us. You know, a sermon can be a liminal experience, especially if I'm giving it. I heard years ago, a good sermon is supposed to bring comfort to the uncomfortable and discomfort to those who are comfortable. Have you heard that one before? Yeah, Pat's saying yes. A good sermon is supposed to move you, disturb you just a little bit. Hopefully not so much that you start picking up rocks, but just enough that you know that you're hearing something that you didn't know before. Something that just is tweaking you this much. You know, I truly believe if I'm not tweaking you, I'm not doing my job up here. Every week, every time at bat, I'm trying to present something that will tweak you at least a little bit. Unless you're already tweaked, then I want to just bring you in and give you a hug. All right? But this can be. Now, how are you going to react when you hear something that just doesn't jive? Hear something that just seems wrong? Hear something that really either angers you? What's your reaction? How do you react? Is it with anger? Is it with defensiveness? Is it with dismissal? Do you get up and walk out, either mentally with your arms crossed or physically actually walk out the door? That's happened in here before. Or do you look at it with a sense of intrigue, a motivation to learn something new, to find out whether this might be true, this might be right, or true for you. What's your reaction to that? You know, and this happens throughout our lives. I walk into a restaurant, and Mary and I are having lunch. Look over at the next table. There are four women sitting there, you know, table for four. All four of them are on their iPhones, texting away, doing whatever they're doing on their iPhones. Nobody is looking at each other. No one is having a conversation. How often do we avoid even the liminal experience of a conversation that might take us someplace other than what we're completely familiar with by hiding behind our technology? We do it over and over again. Confrontations at work, interpersonal difficulties at home or at work. How often do we retreat from those when moving into them, leaning into them, even though they're discomforting and disturbing, can take us someplace that we haven't been before? Teach us something, maybe about another person's point of view. It gets that simple. It doesn't have to be something huge. And we don't have to go looking for stressors. We don't have to go looking for things to disturb us. Life will provide plenty all the time. But you have to take a look and see, how is it that you're reacting to every one of these stressors in your life? And I'm not saying that you have to fight every battle either. Don't get me wrong. But take a look at the pattern of your life. Become aware of what's going on in your life. Become aware of the things that disturb you in your life, the things that push your buttons. And what do over and over again? If you see the pattern of avoidance, if you see the pattern of falling back into either your technology or old patterns, you know, that's what substance abuse is all about, using that as a mask to avoid having to move into the uncomfortable place. The only place from which you will grow. The only place from which you will learn. Scott Peck has a wonderful book called The Road Less Traveled, written way back in 1978, but it's still a classic. I just want to read you a first couple paragraphs from the first page. Just the first page. He has one of the best opening lines of any book, probably since Moby Dick, "Call me Ishmael." How many of you know that? Come on, any literature buffs, thank you. All right. His opening line for The Road Less Traveled is, "Life is difficult." Life is difficult. This is a great truth. One of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. Most do not fully see this truth that life is difficult. Instead, they moan more or less incessantly, noisily or subtly, about the enormity of their problems, their burdens, their difficulties, as if life were generally easy, as if life should be easy. They voice their belief, noisily or subtly, that their difficulties represent a unique kind of affliction that should not be, and that has somehow been especially visited upon them, or else upon their families, their tribe, their class, their nation, their race, or even their species, and not upon others. I know about this moaning because I've done my share. Life is a series of problems. Do we want to moan about them or solve them? Do we want to teach our children to solve them? What makes life difficult is that the process of confronting and solving problems is a painful one. Problems, depending upon their nature, evoke in us frustration or grief or sadness or loneliness or guilt or regret or anger or fear or anxiety, anguish, despair. These are uncomfortable feelings, often very uncomfortable, often as painful as any kind of physical pain, sometimes equaling the very worst kind of physical pain. Indeed, it is because of the pain that events or conflicts engender in us all that we call problems. And since life poses an endless series of problems, life is always difficult and is full of pain as well as joy. Yet it is in this whole process of meeting and solving problems that life has its meaning. Problems are the cutting edge that distinguishes between success and failure. Problems call forth our courage and our wisdom. Indeed, they create our courage and our wisdom. It is only because of problems that we grow mentally and spiritually. When we desire to encourage the growth of the human spirit, we challenge and encourage the human capacity to solve problems. Just as in school, we deliberately set problems for our children to solve. It is through the pain of confronting and resolving problems that we learn. As Benjamin Franklin said, "Those things that hurt, instruct." It is for this reason that wise people learn not to dread, but actually to welcome problems, and actually to welcome the pain of problems. Most of us are not so wise. See, now we can understand James. James 1, verse 2 to 4. "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you might be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." Consider it joy. Welcome the pain of problems. Can we really do this? Should we even be doing this? Is it even morally acceptable? If we can't, we don't grow. If we don't, life becomes unbearable, rooted in fear, constantly, always looking for some sort of medication to get us through another day. I've told this story before, so for those of you who already heard it, I apologize. For the rest of you, last time I had a last secular gig that I had working in an office setting. Problem with the computer, driving me absolutely nuts. Trying to fix it myself for a couple of days, you know, not getting work done, just going out of my mind. Finally call in the computer geek who comes in with his tool belt and his briefcase, you know, and the pocket protector. Sits down at the computer and I tell him what's wrong. He looks at it and he says, "Wow, I've never seen this before. This is great." Perspective. Perspective. Now, true, he was getting paid to fix the problem and I was trying to work through the problem. A little bit different there, but the point remains, he saw something he'd never experienced before, and he knew that when he figured this out, he'd have another arrow in his quiver. He didn't have a pen in his pocket protector that he could use the next time he went out. And he was excited for the challenge. Can we do that? Can we see life not as a burden to bear as we go through the things we go through, but as a challenge, as an opportunity for growth, as an adventure? Y'all seen the movie Hugo? I love that movie, Hugo. There's the one, it's a little boy and a little girl. The little girl has never had an adventure before, so the little boy decides to take her on an adventure, takes her out, runs down into town, and is sneaking her in the back door of a movie theater. And she looks and says, "We could get in trouble for this." He says, "That's how you know it's an adventure." You know, when you take a vacation, and it's all planned out, and you got the itinerary, and everything is just where you want it, and then everything goes wrong? For years afterwards, what are you talking about? The part that went right or the part that went wrong? Because it's the adventure that we treasure. We know that the best things in life are the things that come at us that we didn't see coming, that surprise us and shock us, and somehow we overcome, and we can laugh about them later. You know, I'm going to be doing a wedding next Saturday for Erin, who sings up here, and she has worked for months to try to make everything perfect. But I tell you, it's the things that will go wrong in that ceremony that they will treasure and laugh about for years. You know, if the ring bearer can't find the ring, if the flower girl gets spooked and runs off, they forget their line, somebody trips. Those are the things that we really treasure in life. Why do we consistently try to avoid them? Why do we rage at the machine and the cosmos when such things happen to us? This is our life. This is how it works. You know, we should be getting to the place where we can just go all in. Bet the farm. Get our uniforms dirty. Go for it in life. And when we encounter these difficulties, see it as an adventure. See it as an opportunity for growth. See it as a way to be able to move forward. To let go of the things that we cling to. This pain that we feel day in and day out is putting a spotlight on the things that are wrong with us, the things that we're still clinging to, the things that are blocking us from everything that it is we say we want but can't find because we're sitting in our content-filled mind, not cleared out, not taking the next step. Are we willing to descend into that liminal space, to go through that rite of passage, to be able to clear it all out and meet God's presence, our presence, God's presence? This is the contemplative way. This is what it's all about. This is the way that called me out of all the things I was holding on to. Stone not yet smooth. I'm still taking off layers. But 51%, right? More often than not, can we see life as adventure? Can we meet life's challenges by welcoming them with energy and excitement? Or are we crawling into a fetal position? This is the choice that we have. There's a quote here from Joseph Piper. "For it is contemplation which preserves in the midst of human society the truth which is at one and the same time useless and the yardstick of every possible use. It is also contemplation which keeps the true end in sight, gives meaning to every practical act of life." Paradoxical statements. Chew on that one for a while, because it's the only way this works. It's the paradox that takes us into a liminal space, into the disturbance that takes us out to the other side. Or as Jesus says at Luke 17, "If you cling to your life, you will lose it. And if you let your life go, you will save it." Don't fear the descent. Don't fear the letting go. It's the only way to acquire what really matters. Let's pray. Father, you've created this world in such an amazing way. It defies expectation. It's counterintuitive. It's sometimes crazy and cruel. And yet it's beautiful and it's absolutely perfect. Help us to see the perfection in the midst of the cruelty and the beauty in the midst of the ugliness and atrocity. Help us to focus on you And help us to see the other side as what we need to strip away everything that keeps us from you. This world is what you created for us. Help us to move through it to you. Help us to put down our fears enough that we can just move into these places that stress us. Move into these places that distress us. We just want more of you, Lord. We don't even know exactly what that means, but we know we want it. And so we're coming to you and asking you, what must we do? What must we do? Help us to hear the answer and act upon it. Father, you are amazing. We rededicate ourselves to you this morning. We say that for us and our house, we will serve you. We are yours. And we realize that we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.